Hey, I'm Nancy Wilson.
Mike Campbell.
Mark Mothersbaugh from Devo.
Hey, it's Adam from Counting Crows, and I am here giving you the story behind the song.
The story behind the song is back for season four. I'm Peter Chidi of Deep Cuts Media, and this season we're diving even deeper into some of music history's most iconic tracks with the legends who made them.
What's so beautiful about it is a lot of people connect with, you gotta live your life and don't let the big man push you down. Don't have to live like a refugee, can't keep fighting for what you believe. And that was Tom.
From the spark of inspiration to untold tales from the studio, we unlock the true stories that shape the music you love.
At the time on the radio, there was a really cool riff by Nazareth covering a Joni Mitchell song, This Flight Tonight. It had the same groove, but I think Barracuda kind of blew it out of the water.
Join us as we all sit down with music icons like Devo, Heart, Mike Campbell of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Sublime, Counting Crows, and so many more. New episodes are out now from the Consequence Podcast Network, so tune in wherever you get your podcasts and join me for the story behind the song.
To find out what's really going on behind the music, sometimes you have to dig deep. I'm Dr. Mike, and on the new season of Going There, we're doing just that.
Art or music can be your escape and your therapy.
Going There is the podcast at the crossroads of music and mental health, where we have raw, meaningful conversations with artists like Noah Kahan, Julian Baker, Jason Isbell, Youngblood, The Head and the Heart, and Bishop Briggs.
I recently heard someone describe grief as glitter, where you'll clean it up, and then you'll find little pieces.
By opening ourselves up to these real discussions about mental health, we can foster understanding and gain even greater appreciation for the music we all love.
For me, like, my favorite songs give me happy tears.
So join me and some of your favorite artists on the new season of Going There with Dr. Mike, brought to you by SoundMind Live and the Consequence Podcast Network. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts.
So you want to be a rock and roll star? No? Well, how about a podcast star? Well, as it turns out, there's a new all-in-one platform just for you. It's called Anchor, and it's the easiest way to make a podcast. And check this out, it's free. There's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer, and then Anchor will distribute the podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify and Apple Podcast and, you know, everywhere else in podcast land. And what's even better, you can actually make money from your podcast. Go figure. No minimum listenership on that. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So go ahead, download the free Anchor app right now or go to anchor.fm to get started. So what are you waiting for? Podcast stardom is within your reach.
Do you read Stephen King? Good news. There's a club for you. The Losers Club. Every Friday, us losers journey through the never-ending wastelands of King's Dominion. We sink our teeth into each of King's novels, dive deep into the lore, and review every adaptation. Even better, we're always having guests over. Thomas Jane, Will Wheaton, Mary Lambert, Mick Garris, the list goes on. So what are you waiting for? Join us as we read on through long days and pleasant nights.
Consequence Podcast Network.
And welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's an audio interview series presented by WFPK Independent Louisville at WFPK.org. Consequence of Sounds and the Consequence Podcast Network. If you're not a subscriber to the series, take that moment right now and hit that subscribe button to keep up with all of the interviews that we put out every single week. Usually Monday, Wednesday, and Friday is a schedule. Plenty to keep up with all of your favorite artists. You can do that at iTunes and Apple Podcasts, Spotify and YouTube, and anywhere else you get your favorite podcasts from. I'm Kyle Meredith. Today, my guest, Jill Kniff of Luscious Jackson. We're going to be heading back in time to talk about two of their records, the debut LP Natural Ingredients, which hits 25 this year, released in 1994, and 1999's Electric Honey for its 20th anniversary. We'll hear how the band found their groove-oriented sound and using samples throughout their work and the influence of jazz that was happening in the New York scene in the early 90s, and their super quick ascension into stadium land, thanks to friends in the Beastie Boys and the Breeders and R.E.M. who took them on some of those formative tours. And you may also remember the band appearing on the Clueless soundtrack around that time and in episode of Adventures of Pete and Pete, which we're going to hit on that just a little bit as well. And then for Electric Honey, you know, it was the album after they had had mainstream success with Naked Eye, and it ended up being the final record for a long time for the band. We'll hear why exactly that was, what life was like around that time, and what those songs mean to her these days. Lesha Jackson also put out two records in 2013, which had been the first new music in 15 years at that point. So we're going to start out the interview back in 2013 to talk about both of those, Magic Hour and Baby DJ. And by the end of the whole thing, we'll hear what the future looks like for the band. It's Kyle Meredith with Lesha Jackson.
Hi, Kyle. This is Jill Kniff calling.
Lesha Jackson, we've got two albums to talk about celebrating the big round anniversaries. Natural Ingredients, 25 years old. Electric Honey at 20 years old. And, of course, I'd love to hear, you know, what you've been up to since then, too, because the last time we heard from the band was 2013. You released two records, right?
Yes, we did. We self-produced two releases. One was a kids record called Baby DJ, and one was a full-length Lesha Jackson LP, which was called Magic Hour.
And I loved Magic Hour. I know we played Are You Ready quite a bit over here, and it was so great
cool
to have you all back like that. And I think that's this is probably the part I should say for the end of the interview, but I'm already greedy. It's like, well, it's been 5 years, you know?
Yeah, I know. So I can say that we loved making that album, and we did it with a crowd source called Pledge Music. That was Magic Hour. And basically that we raised money through crowdsourcing for that. And the company was called Pledge Music, and it was a British company. We met with them, and, you know, it was a nice situation for music only. And we were able to really have a good experience, although the workload was astronomical.
Right.
So as anyone who's ever done a Kickstarter will tell you, it's way more work than you realize when you start out in terms of the mail outs. You know, we had like over 1,000 CDs to mail out. And, you know, that's great because people bought CDs. But, you know, basically it was just us and a few volunteers helping us like do these massive amounts of work. So that's part of the reason we haven't done it again. So just the workload of that was not something we want to revisit. So yeah, so it's mostly that. It's mostly like the time and the space to make new music if we just don't have it at the moment. So maybe eventually we'll get back to it, you know?
Well, and the second one, I'll bring that up too, with Baby DJ. You know, I've talked to a lot of artists, or a handful of artists at least, who have went that route, you know, whatever scene they came from, you know, trying out the kid. And it's always been successful to certain degrees, you know, talking with you know, a fellow from the President of the United States who goes by Casper Baby Pants these days, and the Verve Pipe have done that. And of course, like Bare Naked Ladies and everything. And it's work. Was that the intention at all? Like, hey, let's try to see what happens with another route.
Well, we had made that record over a few years when we had little kids, you know, and we didn't really know how to release it. We'd spoken to people about it. We wanted to do a TV show, but everything just kept falling through. So it was just kind of sitting there. So we had it. And then when the Pledge thing came along, it was really like, you know, kids music just doesn't make the same dent, and
right,
people aren't as interested in it, is basically what we were told. And we were like, wow, okay, let's make a new album, like a complete new album from scratch, and go back to our creative process and see what we get. So I had a studio in my house, which I still have, and I'd been working behind the scenes in the music industry for a long time as a songwriter and producer and such. So we were able to do that, you know, just in my studio. And it was great, you know, it was so fun to be back in that creative zone and put that much time into it. And, you know, I love that stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's how that happened. It was sort of like, I think that your fan base is going to be more excited about a new regular album. That's what kind of the general gist of it was, you know.
After the band had been away for a while, I think I was just happy to get one record, but it was like a whole bonus record on top of that, regardless of who the intended fan base was.
Well, we had a lot of people with kids, mm-hmm, you know, so a lot of our fans were coming to that age, and they do listen to it. You know, we have a lot of people with kids who just love that Baby DJ album because they want good kids music and they want dance music. And, you know, that was kind of the intention. It's like you can dance with your family and bring that in and understand rhythm and have that party atmosphere, because a lot of kids' music is really folky, mm-hmm, and you kind of sit around on the ground and you like all sway back and forth. And, you know, so this was like, let's just put beats in this and get everybody dancing.
Yeah.
So, you know, people have said they love it and have really enjoyed it. So that's cool.
I mean, you all were the perfect band to do something like that. And I'm going to use that as the seg to take us, you know, in the Wayback Machine to 1994 for Natural Ingredients, because because coming into the scene, especially off the, you know, your debut EP was all of this groove oriented music that listening to now today still sounds fresh, and it still sounds, I don't know how you listen to it versus how I listen to it is probably quite different, but for me, there is definitely a time and a place in that, but it doesn't sound exactly dated.
Well, thank you. You know, I've been listening to a lot of stuff. I have a daughter now who's a musician, and she's 15. So I've been going back through music history with her, stuff that I've loved. And, you know, that was a time, I would say early 90s, where there were all these great records out that had the beats on, like the D-Light records, you know. Mm-hmm. So we were listening to D-Light and Groovers in the Heart. And then we're listening to ESG, which was like this band from the Bronx with these three sisters, and they played this amazing minimal dance music. And so stuff like that I'm pulling out for her, she's like, oh my God, this stuff is amazing. We don't do this anymore. Why isn't music like this? Where's all the grooves, and where is it? You know, so we're kind of on this, like, we're constantly looking for grooves, and it's not that, it's not really the backbone of a genre currently in the way that it was. And there are a lot of related bands to what we were doing. So it's interesting, you know, it's like, okay, this generation has like its own genres, which are great, but we don't have that one exactly, which, you know, some of it looping, you know, hearing a drum loop, mm-hmm. and how that feels. A lot of that music was based on old, like Motown drum loops and break beats. So that particular kind of groove that was like underneath all the hip hop and dance music of that time, like people aren't really doing that right now.
So where did that come from for you? You know, because it was obviously the loops and the groove and sampling. I mean, sampling was a big part of what you all were doing too. Where did that come out of your own curiosity, or how did you find that path?
You know, when I look back, I see how much we were part of a scene, or so to speak, or we were all influencing each other. So you've got the Beastie Boys, who are our close friends, who are helping us put our music out, though not like they weren't producing us or guiding us in terms of any of that. We did all of that, but that was part of the scene. You know, the hip hop, the De La Soul and the D-Light, Tribe Called Quest, all of those EPMD, all those groups that were coming out at that time were sampling. So Public Enemy, Jungle Brothers, all the hip hop stuff. So we were just entranced with that stuff and wanted to add onto it our other elements. So we loved post-punk. We loved the Slits. We loved, you know, all the female post-punk groups. I loved Joni Mitchell. We loved Motorhead. You know, so we were like, how do we just slam all this stuff and use some of those loops underneath and create this new mix? And that's what we constantly set out to do, is like, let's just put all our influences together and see what comes out, you know? So that's how it happened.
Talking about how, you know, there's no grooves in that sort of way these days. And as you said, how you get into that way. Jazz also seemed to be, you know, in a really nice point for that. That's something I do wish would come back around. And I don't know if that's being nostalgic or whatever, but having that jazz with the beats and everything, because that was like the New York scene. That's how I imagine the early 90s New York scene.
Yes, it was. We had a lot of clubs. We had Giant Step, which was basically an event that that was put on by a production company, but it was all jazz and hip hop. So all the jazz, hip hop influence, you know, I love jazz because my dad was in World War II and he was an older dad, and I grew up with all this jazz. And I think a lot of the people of our age did. So that was like already in our childhoods. And then throwing in these loops, it was like magic, you know, and I put that stuff on sometimes. I'm like, I love this, you know, and Us Three, remember how big Us Three was?
Right.
And there was just, you know, Tribe Called Quest constantly using jazz. And, you know, this is a real backbone of that time as well. And now that's gone. Like nobody listens to jazz now, or at least no kids are going to be relating to a track with jazz. It's unusual. Somebody could do it, and I'd be curious to see if it grabs them.
Because you have folks like Kamasi Washington, who's doing interesting things in jazz, but it doesn't seem to be reaching younger folks, I guess. And maybe it's because it needs
maybe
a beat.
I don't know about it. Maybe you know, maybe there's stuff out there. I'm just not aware of it, so I don't know.
It needs a beat. That's what I think. That's what it is.
It needs that groove. It needs a groove.
It does.
Yeah.
So how did that work for you in the writing process? You know, if you don't mind going really deep in the weeds here, because writing a song on an acoustic guitar can be one thing, but I would think that writing a song in that nature would be completely different.
Yeah, it's writing. I mean, that it's like collage, and a lot of us have art background, so it made a lot of sense. I mean, fine art. It made a lot of sense to be, and you know, to be able to take this element and that element and just fuse them. And there were keyboards back then, sampling keyboards, where you could play the samples up and down. I'm sure they still exist. You can play the samples up and down the keyboard, change the pitch, change the speed. So then you're able to really meld these things into something. And it was so much fun and so different. And we just loved it. So writing, you know, I grew up writing on acoustic guitar. So did Gabby. So, you know, that's how we played guitars and regular rock band and drums. And, you know, once these samples started coming in, it was just like, now we found it.
I'll point out one of those famously, you know, you use On and On by Gladys Knight on City Song. That track becomes a moderate hit out of the gate for you guys. And then it seems, at least on paper in history, to move really, really quickly for you all. I mean, of course, you had the BC Association, so there you are opening up for them, and REM, you do that one in arenas, right? I mean, you kind of, it looks like you all go from, like, beginning to arenas really, really quickly.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, I don't think we understood how fast it was because we were just going on the ride. But yes, we started with opening for the, first we opened for Betty Cerviert, which was like a band from Holland, uh-huh. which indie band, but then to the Breeders, which was like kind of a cool jump. And they were going all over Europe. So we did that. Then we went with the Beastie Boys around mostly Europe. Then we did, you know, we did our own shows in between here as well. You know, I should add, we were constantly on tour. But then we got to do the REM shows, and those were huge. So, you know, we were the opener to REM. So the fans were really there for them. But those are the kind of things that expose you to this huge audience. So that's what we were doing. And we did a ton of in-stores, a ton of radio performance. In-stores would be like performing in the store back when there were record stores. And now there's like two. So that would be like, you get to the town, you go to the record store, you set up a mini gig, you perform maybe like 20 minutes, then you do all the signing of everything and people buy CDs and meet you. Then you go to the sound check. You know, this is all the same day. So you need to have a lot of energy. Then you go to the sound check, do that. Then you do more interviews at the sound check. Then you eat a quick dinner, get ready for the show, do the show, and then possibly a meet and greet. So that's why people get tired on the road.
And then you add in the other things. I mean, in this time, you know, right after this, Saturday Night Live, House of Style, and I should point out The Adventures of Pete and Pete, which had to be a cool experience.
Yes. And people think that for some reason we're holding up Pete and Pete's season 3 or whatever, but we're not.
Weird. Yeah. Oh, like music rights.
Yeah. We have no idea what that is. So just to clear the record, no one's ever talked to us from the corporate world about it, you know, so I don't know.
Well, I guess we'll clear that.
Don't know what that is.
That air is cleared anyway. But, you know, you do have it. And that's what I say, you know, when things happen so quickly, did you find that you were quick to adapt to the situation?
Yeah, we just went with it. You know, we were 100% all in, totally excited. It was our dream. We were all music kids, you know, club kids in New York that lived for music. It was our religion of sorts. And that's what we believed in. You know, we believed that music was progressing. Music was great. Music was going to change everything, bring people together. You know, that was why we were so excited about it. Sort of like a mission of sorts. Like, we're just going to keep doing this. Wow, we get to go out in the world and play our music and meet people. And, you know, it was really great.
But you did. You did change things. And I think it's been said, you know, for a lot of bands who are the ones to revolutionize a sound, they're usually the ones left behind. And I don't know if you've ever felt that, because it seems like you did. You were one of the bands that did help propel a sound. And a lot of bands came after you that maybe got a bit more of that spotlight.
I guess so. I think that we were definitely a niche thing that, you know, we had some hits, you know, so that was kind of cool. But I always felt like, gosh, we got out of New York and our sound was like much harder to explain. So people would kind of scratch their heads, like, how are you combining these things, you know?
Right.
And if we went to Europe, there would definitely be, you know, if we opened for the Beastie Boys, they'd be like, we want rap music. So it was like, okay, we're not just going to do hip hop, you know, we're doing like this blend of things. And it was definitely like a harder sell. New York, it made sense. New York is all blended. Everyone's at the clubs listening to the DJs throw this on, then that, then this, you know, different genre mixing. So it just made absolute sense coming from New York. And then you step out and you go, whoa, the world is not all from this place. And, you know, I think that's probably the thing that made us have the hardest time was our perspective, mm-hmm. our musical perspective.
Like what I think, like the groove-oriented bands that came after, and maybe that's the stuff that starts to turn into what became like the trip-hop sound and everything. But I'll point out, like, that's how I read history. I think you all were always a very big band to me, and I was in the middle of Kentucky, you know, and of course, by that point, I didn't, you know, I wasn't able to find you all till Naked Eye probably became a hit, you know, and really was all the way out there on MTV. But, you know, from that point on, you all might as well have been the biggest band in the world to someone in the middle of nowhere.
Right. I think that people experienced it in their own way. And, you know, when you're in the band, you're constantly hearing from the record company how it has to be bigger and more. And we need this more, not enough, you know, so that's part of the behind the scenes, because it's a commercial endeavor from a major label, any label, small, big, they have to sell records and they've invested. So there's this whole business structure that you don't think about when you're young and you're having fun. And, you know, we did the best we could to like have a great time and then interface with people who are like, we need a bigger hit. We need more hits. This radio station is not playing it. We need blah, 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 blah. That's kind of the stuff that's going on all the time.
What a way to buzzkill the fun right there.
It's like you have to just separate yourself, you know, and just be like, okay, you guys just talk to our manager about that. And well, they try to kind of set a line so you go and have fun and you experience it with your fans, which is the main fun. Is
right.
You go out and you have this great live show and you meet people and they're having so much fun. And, you know, so we were able to do that. So that's good.
Yeah. And, you know, I'll quickly point out, I mean, just favorites. Like, I mean, Here was such a great song, and Deep Shag and Energy Suckers. And it's a freaking great record. So then we'll we'll jump you know, a few years there, and we'll jump over, you know, the middle era and head to 1999, because that's when Electric Honey comes out, which ends up being the final Luscious Jackson record for a little while. But this was the first record after sort of mainstream breakthrough success with Naked Eye and the record Fever In, Fever Out. Did that have an effect on how you wanted to be a band at that point, having mainstream success?
I mean, we just wanted it to continue, I guess. And we wanted to have radio hits, because when you have radio hits, then people go to your shows and you can play more. You can have a salary of some kind. You know, it's basic stuff. So we wanted that and we did our best. And I think that the radio had changed and the rock stations that we'd formerly been on, you know, like Naked Eye actually was played on rock, modern rock stations, and then was able to go to top 40. Like those stations at that time stopped playing female artists, and the female artists were put onto, there were these female stations from Lilith Fair, which I loved Lilith Fair, but this was like unfortunate.
Right.
Thing that happened. So the female stations that they started playing music on weren't really very powerful, and the modern rock stations really were. And that's sort of what happened to our record. It was like Lady Fingers was the single. We were rolling it out. You know, everything was looking good. The video was cool. Everything was nice. And then like, nope, can't get it on the radio properly. So that was kind of the end of the whole thing, you know? And if you don't have radio on a major label, you don't have much longevity, because that's what they do.
And what a really crappy time for rock radio, because that was when things started really getting aggressive. That's when the active rock thing came in. That's when, you know, all of those bands, you know, and I mean, you can see that, you know, as people just look back at the 20th anniversary of Woodstock 99. I mean, it's just painted right there in popular culture, you know, what happened. And it happened so quickly. Last year, I was talking with Dan Wilson, you know, about how the Semisonic was able to sneak that record in at the last second, you know, before everything changed, because it happened overnight. And I remember it well and remember hating it at that moment in real time.
Yeah, it was like the curtain, you know, drew closed and this whole other thing happened, which I think we just felt totally, you know, disconnected from. We'd been on these great tours, like we were on Lollapalooza, that was this really interesting mixes of bands, you know, and hip-hop, rock, old funk. You know, they'll have, like, George Clinton on there. They'll have Tribe Called Quest. They'll have Beastie Boys. They'll have Smashing Pumpkins. They'll have whatever. It was the Breeders. You know, like, these really interesting mixed tours. And then it was like, okay, this whole thing is different now. It just really felt like the end of an era by the time we kind of brought out our last album.
Which, you know, point out, as I read, you all are the only band to have played a Lollapalooza and Lilith at the same time, which says, I guess, a lot about to all of the audiences. You spoke at it at once.
Yeah, I mean, those were great tours. Lilith was fantastic, you know, and so was Lollapalooza. So those were also how we got our exposure. You know, with Lollapalooza, that was probably our big, I guess it's like a break of sorts, sort of like the REM thing, where it's just the number of people who saw us, the number of autographs we signed and shirts and CDs that we were signing. You just saw people loving it and gathering sort of out. We were on the second stage and we have photos of like all these people for the first time. We've gone, whoa, look at all these people. Wow, you're not playing a tiny club, you know?
You know, a little bit more about Electric Honey. Did I read right that you studied opera before going into the record?
I did. I studied opera with this teacher in Manhattan who's recently died. Her name was Marnie Nixon, and she was actually a singer for movies, and she did Natalie Wood's voice in West Side Story. So she was a behind the scenes, she would fill in the vocals for people. So she was much older, and it was really interesting to learn that style of singing from her, you know, just learning that at all. It's right. Like, wow. But it did help my singing a lot. I learned a lot and it improved my vocals, I think.
I mean, was that just a personal quest right there?
Yeah, it was just like, I want to improve my vocals. I tried some other teachers. Someone recommended her. She was a really cool person and she taught me a lot. And I carry it with me to this day, like a lot of the stuff she taught me. So it was really cool.
Did pairing down to a trio change the dynamics of the writing for you all going into that record?
Yes, it did. And, you know, Vivian went off and did another group called Dusty Trails with Josephine Wiggs from the Breeders. Mm-hmm. So they had their own separate band going and we had ours. But, you know, we kind of went back to working for the one with Naked Eye, that record we worked with Daniel Lanois, who was a really famous producer and had produced U2, and that was remarkable and also really educational. So this next one, we went back to our original collaborator, Tony Mangurian, and for This Is the 99 record, and we also used a few other producers, and we kind of brought it back from like into track by track, I guess,
right.
And thinking of each track with a separate producer as opposed to one producer for the whole thing. And
yeah.
We did a lot of it in New York. We were able to go around. That's kind of how we're used to doing it. We kind of go around to studios and work in the studios and in the Lanois record. We were in New Orleans for a lot of it in his studio Kingsway, which was magnificent. So it was just, we're just trying everything, you know, just right. Experimenting.
Yeah. I love a quote that you had around there. Somebody asked you about the record and you said, this record is me better at life.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
I think they were talking about maybe the lyrics or the themes and everything, but I love that you said it's about me better at life.
I think that's true. It was always like very personal and trying to improve and get better, you know, get healthier in every way. And, you know, I continue on with that idea. And I think, you know, the lyrics, a lot of the lyrics are personal in that way. So there is a lot of, you know, my own life in there, my own experiences. And I actually went into songwriting after that and saw how different that approach is than what is usually done in terms of like providing songs for artists. So it was a big shift. Like, we don't really care about your personal life. Now you need to just write something that works for this person, you know? So it's interesting.
Well, I love that one just as much. I mean, I can dump the compliments on you for all of these.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. So, you know, I think you answered at the beginning, and it's always the question, but do you foresee that there will be any more Lesha Jackson records in the future?
I think we all are open to it, and is what also shows, you know, we were doing shows until 2016. We would always do, like, we did a New York show. We had a few shows in 2014, kind of bigger, like bigger cities. And then we can't get away that much because people are in jobs and they have kids, you know, so it's not, we don't have that free time to just go and we're not independently wealthy, nor do we have free time. So there you have it. We're average Americans with kids. So basically people have jobs and that's been the biggest problem. I think we'd all like to do it at some point and that we still exist as a band. Mm-hmm. And we have We actually just started making T-shirts. They're available on Amazon. So we brought back a lot of our T-shirt designs with a friend of mine. So it's, you know, our vintage 90s graffiti logos, In Search of Manny cover, Natural Ingredients. So those are all on Amazon right now, which is kind of fun.
Yeah.
And, you know, we may do music when we have some time. It really is just that. It's just people. Kate lives in California, and she's a producer on TV show. So she works on James Corden.
Oh, that little thing.
And she's right. And it's like a it's very, you know, you really have to devote yourself to these things. And we also have kids, and my kids are now older, but they have younger kids, Gabby and Kate. So people are just very busy. Right. And, you know, we've tried a few times to kind of say, let's do another show. And it's sort of like, I just can't pull it off right now. So, you know, we'll see. We might be like old gray haired ladies. With flowing gray hair. That's something that I used to talk about with Gabby. It's like, maybe we'll be like those old ladies with purple hair.
Uh-huh.
You know, they dye their gray white hair purple. And we'll be out there with our guitars, you know.
I would show up for it.
But, yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'm like, people would come, you know. I'm like, you know, we're still the same people inside. We just look old now. We don't look old, but in 20 years, we're going to look like seniors, you know, or 30 years. So we'll just be like these long, flowing gray hair. Emmy Lou Harris does it, and she's a friend of mine.
Exactly.
And she keeps going, and her fans keep going, and she looks great, and she is great. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, what's the problem? You know, it's just by then, maybe we'll have a little more time. So right. We're kind of just in the thick of it right now, and then maybe like 5 more years, it's going to slow down, and we'll be able to regroup, you know, or maybe in 3 years. Who knows?
Well, there are those artists, you know, Sade, Fiona Apple, both of those come to mind. Like, it's now like a record every 10 years. So, you know, if you do that, you're still on track.
Right. So we could potentially do that.
Right. Honestly, you know, somewhat pun intended with the last record, Magic Hour, but it seems like the magic is always there with you all. And it was so great to hear it then. So if it happens again, I will so be looking forward to it.
All right. You know, I realized that, too. And people, you know, as I am with artists I love, I love Nena Cherry, for example. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. She's someone I've loved since the late 80s. And she had Buffalo Stance, and she's someone I always buy her records. And it may be every 3 or 5 years or 10 years. But when it comes out, I'm going to the show. I want to hear what she's doing. You know, so that's how it is. If you love the artist, you're going to go. And that we know that. So we always think about that, you know, like, all right, maybe we could do this again, you know, when we have a little more free time. Yeah. So
she put out a record this year, didn't she?
She did. And I was listening to it. It's very dark. It's you know, you think of her as being a pop artist, but her last two things have been very not pop. More experimental. And, you know, I think with Trump's election, she made something kind of just dark. You know, I like
right.
it a lot.
I've got to go back and listen to that one because I remember it kind of, I remember seeing it and thinking, oh, cool. And then there's so much music out there. And I think it just went away
exactly.
really quickly.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
I listen to it a lot. And she doesn't do a huge tour. You know, she'll play like New York. So she lives in Europe. So basically, like, I listen to it a lot, but be prepared that it's not pop, and it's good, though.
Absolutely.
It has some really good stuff on it. Check it out. Cool. Yeah.
Well, Jill, thank you so much for the talk today and heading back on these records. I really can't thank you enough. It's so great to talk to you for the first time, and I'll look forward to whatever happens next.
Yes, please. We'll be in touch.
All right. Thank you so
All right,
much.
Thanks. Bye. All right, bye.
Big old thanks to Jill Cunha from Luscious Jackson, Natural Ingredients, 25 years old, Electric Honey, 20 years old, and I guess technically Magic Hour and Baby DJ, 5 years old. So also, I want to mention, outside of the music thing, Jill spends a lot of her time these days concentrating on a different kind of artwork, more of the visual kind. You can actually see that artwork on her website, jillcunniffstudio.com. Her last name is spelled C-U-N-N-I-F-F, jillcunniffstudio.com. And she tells me she's going to be doing another show and performance in New York City in 2020. And the cool thing about these showings is in those performances, she does play some of the classic Luscious Jackson songs. So you get really two great sides of an artistic personality right there. So make sure to keep an eye on her website and social media spots as well. And that does it. Before you get out of here, don't forget to hit that subscribe button wherever you're listening from right now. Again, you can do that to iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube. Wherever's good for you in the podcast world, hit that subscribe button. We put out interviews every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. After that, head to WFPK.org. That's where I do a show Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern, an hour full of brand new songs, anniversary celebrations, music news, and clips from these interviews as well. That's WFPK.org. ConsequenceOfSound.net has your music and film news. You can also find me at Twitter at Kyle Meredith and Facebook/Kyle Meredith. And that does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.